I'm Charlie Mays, and the topic tonight has to do with Am I a Christian? Old and new definitions. And I want to say a couple of things. I overheard the conversation last night in which you, as a community, struggled with that question, and I want to just say a couple of things at the beginning about my observation. First of all, as I visited with some of the other pastors who are in the village today, most of us would give just about anything to have a situation in our congregation where we could have conversations like that, where we could depend upon having a community that trusted one another enough to share concerns in the way that you did last night. So I want to begin by giving that kind of expression of appreciation. You're to be encouraged to continue that, and I also have no illusions about the fact that what I'm going to say tonight will settle anything. In fact, it's my hope to unsettle it. I also realize that the composition of this group is very different than the one last night. So I think it's going to be a very different conversation. But I hope that some of the concerns and some of the issues that people from the community raised will occur for us again. What I'd like to do is to say a few kind of prefatory things by way of provocation, and I hope I will provoke from the kind of the left wing where I would like to live but don't. And I'd like to start. It occurred to me that in the preface to a book written a long time ago, so long ago that it's very sexist in its title, Rollo May, in a book called Man's Search for Himself, has a line that I've always remembered. And the line is this: one of the advantages of living in an age of anxiety is it brings you face to face with the question, who am I? And I think maybe that the discussion that the village has been having about whether I'm Christian or not, and who is Christian, is really a kind of a surfacing of a debate that is going on all over the place in the church. Another quote from a lay person in my first congregation, he said, it looks to me like that for us, most of the time, our identity is a function of the negative. You know, I am not this and I am not that, and Jesus even seemed to me, if I remember, told a parable about that. But at least I'd like to have us think for a while, and I think part of this discussion that I overheard last night was not only a struggle to name who we are as a community and what our boundaries are and who is in, but probably underneath that is the question about who's going to do that defining. And one of the interesting things about historical movements is that their names and a lot of their definitions usually come from their enemies. From other people give them the name and kind of help them with the identity. So in some sense, our identity is almost always a given. And another way, in terms of the communal part of it, I think it's always given. But anyway, then we own it, I suppose, another way to say it. Well, let me get on to two kind of books I want, or authors I want to deal with as a way to springboard into this. I am a avid fan of Chaim Potok. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Chaim Potok, who is a Hasidic rabbi. A gifted writer, I think, and the thing that I love about him is that he can ask the same kind of questions that we labor with, only since he's dealing with them in his arena, they're not so emotionally charged for me. And so I want to comment on first on two books, in The Chosen and The Promise. Those are books about the same character. It's a character who is the more brilliant son of a very brilliant Hasidic rabbi. And it is assumed by the whole committee or the whole community that this son is going to become a rabbi, but he chooses instead to become a psychologist. And in the course of that, he becomes, has to become, he thinks, increasingly secular. So at important junctures in his story, we meet with crises of identification, like for the Hasidic Jew, who one of the marks for the males is to have the earlocks. And when he's faced with a crisis, shall I cut those buggers off or not? It's a crisis of identity. Can you cut that earlock off and still be Jewish in the Hasidic tradition? What about the skull cap? Can we take that off, not wear that, and still be Jewish? Where are, to use the language of this debate, the boundaries, the edges? And we can laugh and think, isn't it silly, ha ha ha, that some people would find their religious identification in earlocks. I mean, some of us who have got the kind of hair I have would be in crisis right away by Yahweh's action or somebody's. But so we think, oh, that's kind of silly. But what is it in our tradition that may be equally as silly that marks boundaries for us? So Chaim Potok pushes those questions for us. I think that Chaim Potok's literary agenda is really spelled out in the book called The Book of Lights. I think that's the most autobiographical of his work, because he too was a chaplain in Korea, like the characters in the book. And when these characters in the book go to Korea to be chaplains during the Korean conflict, they take R&R in Tokyo and in Hong Kong and all throughout the Far East, and they make an observation. And the observation is this: here are a billion people who never heard of Judaism, who live their lives relatively well, morally, and you know, they're not better or worse necessarily than those who have grown up in the Jewish tradition. Who know all about that tradition. So what do you make of that? And I think that's something that Chaim Potok is struggling with. So he's very helpful to me to get at some of these questions. I don't know what his answers are. I think he just likes to raise questions. In fact, one of the little sales blurbs on the back of the Book of Light says, this is just, there are no brilliant answers here, just brilliant questions or something like that. And I think they're absolutely right. But the other thing I want to struggle with, and I'm going to bring this up very specifically, I think, and I've been convinced by the historical critical methodology of the study of the scripture and of the Christian tradition, that I would be so bold as to say that there's virtually no practice that we have that we didn't borrow from somebody, probably pagan in the first place. I mean, there isn't one of us in the room who wouldn't admit that a good bit of what we borrowed from the mother womb of Judaism. So the first little boundary problem we've got is that we brought it in rather than it being forced in. I'm going to share a little quote that's even better about that from another book in a minute. But Chaim Potok raises the same question in a just absolutely what, for me, is my favorite of his books, My Name is Asher Lev. And I suppose it's the reason for it comes because of what this artist has to struggle with. And roughly, just to give you a quick overview, Asher Lev is a young Jewish boy who is skilled. A gifted artist. I mean, right away, he loves to draw and all of that, and it's crisis in the family because you shall make no graven images and all of it. I mean, the plastic arts are not big in Judaism, right? It's the last Jewish sculptor you saw. I mean, it's so And so what's the family going to do with him? And they have some encouragement by an uncle, as I remember the story. But you can't escape this kind of passage. And I want to pick it up particularly because of how it addresses this question. He's convinced that there are no great artists. In fact, his artistic agent tells him this, that don't paint crucifixions. So what's he going to do? He finally chooses to paint one, and the composition of it is just marvelous for all kinds of reasons. And I want to just pick up at a point here. He says, I painted swiftly in a strange, nervous frenzy of energy. For all the pain you suffered, my mama, for all the torment of your past and future years, my mama, for all the anguish this picture of pain will cause you, for the unspeakable mystery that brings good fathers and sons into the world and lets a mother watch them tear at each other's throats, for the master of the universe, whose suffering world I do not comprehend, for the dreams of horror, for nights of waiting, for memories of death, for the love I have for you, for all the things I remember, and for all the things I should remember but have forgotten. For all these things I created this painting, an observant Jew working on a crucifixion, because there was no ascetic mode in his own religious tradition into which he could pour a painting of ultimate anguish and torment. I think he really caught the problem that we want to deal with here. At least I want to deal with, and I'm doing talking. So okay. The pastors who have been with me this week are going to now throw up on their shoes. Because one more time I'm going to mention Ernst Käsemann's Jesus Means Freedom, and I bought the last two of them in the bookstore. Because both my associates are so tired of me talking about this. They said, bring us a couple of those buggers back. So here they are. But I read this book just simply to get juiced up from time to time. And this brings me down now back to what I think is the core question. This book was written by Ernst Käsemann in anger at the German church over the same kind of debate and kind of stuff. But anyway, he writes this. He quotes Adolf Schlatter. He says, our faith rests on what Adolf Schlatter in his last little book expressed in the question, do we know Jesus? And on nothing else, whatever the volumes of dogmatics and creeds may consider necessary. But if that is so, the problem that faces us is not merely the exact nature of Jesus' uniqueness and whether it consisted partly in the liberal attitude of his earthly life, nor in the question about the real nature of the church. The problem is an ultimate one that goes deeper. It is, in the last resort, about God himself. Now, do we know Jesus? He thinks Jesus is the key to knowing God. And maybe it's not so much the church needs to worry about its boundaries. It needs to worry about its center. That may be a helpful way to get off of worrying about that kind of thing. But maybe not. I don't know. I'm going to skip. I could just kind of go through this little bugger and just throw you out all kinds of things He says, the freedom of a Christian is not given to us ready-made at birth. And even after baptism, we have to find our way to it very laboriously. All the councils that ever existed and all of that kind of stuff, all the volumes of devotional work and theological work and dogmatic work and everything won't settle it for us. We got to keep at it. And I think he's absolutely right about that. Now, he has a thesis that I rather like. He says there isn't anything that has arisen in the church that we didn't in the first place come about as a result of necessity. All the discipline in the church, there was probably a reason for it or whatever. It may not have been a good reason, but we got a reason for it. And so the historical contingency gave rise to some practice. Then the question gets to be, what happens after the historical contingency has passed? When I came into the ministry, we had to buy candles that had 51% beeswax in them. Now, I still haven't figured that out, but, but I think it had something to do with the tradition, that somehow that was natural wax. And since beeswax was getting more expensive than paraffin, you'd have to, you know, and all of that. I don't know. Did you ever have that problem, Paul, in your early days?
We used to melt them up again.
Melt them, yeah. Yeah. Okay, now two more little, this I just want to share this with you because it is so poetic about this, and I absolutely love it. I don't know if he was this poetic in the German or the translator got at it. Castles of defense into which one flees from danger become castles of defiance from which one cannot break away when the time comes to change from the defensive to the offensive. The little band had seen in its salvation and discipline. He's talking about the pastoral epistles here. So the little band had seen its salvation and discipline, but discipline soon began to use the rod. Once a person is compelled to get used to living in a cramped space, narrow-mindedness follows almost inevitably. The pastoral epistles and their historical after effects provide excellent material for a study of all this. We've been doing Luke up here, and I tell you how much I love Luke. He's totally off base on Luke. Take my word for it. I mean, he just doesn't understand. Okay, last little thing. This is the point I want to get into, and then we can have our fun discussion. He said, and I believe this. I mean, I can trace you. I think at least if you can trust scholarship and all of that, that even in the scriptural witness itself, until the contact with Persia, which I always think is this just terribly ironic thing since it's present-day Iran, we didn't have language for resurrection, we didn't have language for angels or messengers and all kinds of stuff. That's fairly clearly traceable to us from that Persian influence. So, you know, God uses other voices and whatever, I think, to give us some equipment to draw our own pictures. Anyway, this, he says, we ought to recognize and concede the pagan antecedents of all these sacred matters. Jesus, the cultic God, the holy year is the background of the calendar and of life, the priestly office which makes the rest of God's people the laity, the holy place which is to be approached with pious awe and is separated by thick walls from the world, and the ceremony which brings us into the company of the angels and saints. That is how the church is seen everywhere today by believers and unbelievers. A person's membership of it is decided by his or her either participating in it or by not knowing what to make of it. We have to see before us him who walked the country roads of Galilee and Samaria to Jerusalem with no home of his own and associating with everyone, if we are to appreciate the far-reaching contrast between the beginnings and the present day. If he had wanted to have the present day situation, he could have founded a sanctuary such as the Qumran community in the desert and sent his missionaries out from there. In that case, the cross itself would hardly have been needed. Neither Jews nor Romans nor Greeks had any objection to a new cult. But there must be something wrong with our setup if we have landed in such a contrast to Jesus himself. We cannot justify it with reference to Golgotha, Easter, and Pentecost if it involves the loss of his reality and his own self. None of the churches want to hear that the world is no longer being bothered with cults, but that is, in any case, it would find him thrilling, aggravating, and liberating if it could only get sight of him. Well, that ought to do something. I mean, that's obviously a perspective that says, hey, what are you worried about the boundaries? And I'm not too sure that, I mean, I think I could marshal arguments that would counter the thing when I say we ought to be concerned only about the center. But I'd like to at least propose that, and then we can just have a discussion. It's just interesting that in the Lutheran tradition, which is a reforming tradition, and I keep trying to push this argument. Everybody says we are a liturgical church. That's right, but deeper than that, we are a reforming tradition. And so that means even that stuff is up for grabs, I think. I mean, so I like to push the edges, and I don't mind doing that, because the part of the thing about a community is it's going to keep you intact. You know, Luther, for all of his rebellion and all of that, he if Roland Bainton is to be trusted in his Here I Stand, said Luther went around always with this nagging question: how can I be right and the whole church wrong? And I kind of like that attitude. But anyway, let's visit. I've said far more than enough, and that may just be stirring the pot, and I don't know. It's talk or freeze.
that quote you made from Castleman about the castles being built for defensive purposes and then remaining when the threat was gone was very good, because as I was thinking of when the best comes out of me is not when I am in a defensive position, when I'm trying to defend my ego or my turf or my family or my role in the church. That's not when the Christ is most present in me. There's lots of other things that come into play. And so I like myself, and I think I probably serve my Lord better when I'm not being defensive.
You know, one of the other things I could have thrown out here, and I think it's really a question to be wrestled with. Tradition, by its very root word, means that which is handed on. And we just can't exist without tradition. And when you think about it, I want to use a very mundane example. We have a tradition which has been codified by law that we drive on the right-hand side, you know, so that we always meet somebody on our left. Think of what if we didn't have that tradition. And every car you met, you'd have to decide, now left or right. And so when you're playing with tradition, you know, what's the essence of that? And then what, I heard a guy one time talk about tradition with a capital T and traditions with a small t. And we get preoccupied with the little t's, because it's easier. I mean, the big T is a big problem. Just what is the tradition? So anyway. See, there's some biblical scholars who think that as you move down through the history of the church councils, for example, that the faith becomes more and more Greek noun-oriented rather than Hebrew verb-oriented. And so you get more and more concerned about the nature of Jesus and not the work of Jesus. And, there's all kinds of ways to look at this. And so, you know, another quote from Kaiserman, he says, you know, do we know Jesus? He says it. And so we have to constantly be learning. And he says, when you're dealing with Jesus, the learning is never done. So anyway, but enough of my preaching. Paul?
Now, I'm interested in what you're saying about the center as over against the limits or the boundaries. And I'm thinking about Holden and the rather few statements there are about what Holden is about. You know, there's a lot of stuff. But it keeps reiterating that the center is the gospel. And I have struggled with that a great deal, because when I came here, and you know, you're on the board, one of the things, about the only thing the board said to me was that somehow we got to preserve the proclamation of the gospel. And of course, all my life I've struggled with that question, what is the gospel? And I think I know what it is for myself. But to me, that tries to express some kind of a center. It doesn't express the boundaries, but it expresses the center.
You know, just to illustrate the difficulty of the issue that Paul raises, about 10 years ago, the Lutheran World Federation, U.S. Department, or whatever it's called, issued a study document. It's a gray-covered 8.5 by 11 booklet on studies and doctrines. And they had different things. I don't know if any of you remember seeing that. But they had theologians from the Missouri Synod, from the ALC and the LCA respond to the same questions. And you had to wonder how in the world we were the same level when it came to the definition of what the gospel is. Because as I remember that, the Missouri Synod theologians said essentially the gospel is the whole Bible.
Not if they read Walther.
Well,
gospel.
That could be a little problem, but I mean that's again there's a tradition that we, you know, but I mean it's an interesting thing. I mean our definitions and others' definition of that is tremendous. And what we've gotten into in our tradition, Lutheran tradition, is that yours is wrong then. And Kaiserman has another little statement in here. He says, "What would happen if we started out accepting and rejoicing over what God has given to the brother or sister, what he's revealed to them that he hasn't revealed to us, rather than for us to lament what they have not gotten by our lights, as if we are the measure by which they're to be judged, rather than the gift which God has given to them, which is always, he says, the measure of judgment." Anyway.
This isn't so much a question as an observation, but we of the United Church of Christ tradition often get criticized for the fact that we're so fuzzy about who we are and what we have proclaimed and all that. And in fact, that's the criticism in evangelism for all of the mainline now being called old line or even sideline churches, and that they can't define what their identity is, and they're therefore not attracting anybody. And it's the people who have the strict boundaries, the churches that have the strict boundaries, that are attracting others.
Maybe, you know, my thing would be maybe to find the center again. Kaiserman thinks Jesus is kind of an attractive character. but what that means, too, is...
Yeah, who is Jesus?
Yeah.
The thing you talk about with Luther walking around going, you know, how can I be right and the whole church wrong, kind of expresses that dynamic dialectic tension that I think needs to go on in the church, and many times doesn't, in which the single voice or small group of voices speak one area, and then that kind of creates or hopefully creates some kind of a climate in which the larger part of the community struggles with that. And there's this movement back and forth that tends to keep us from getting off into a certain kind of privatized individualistic expression, and at the same time pulls the church away from that narrowness that living in a castle can kind of bring. And that's a tension that needs to occur, and many times is so scary for us, so difficult for us to engage in individually and culturally and institutionally, that we shy away from it and rapidly sometimes drop into personalities rather than issues. Someone was talking about the dialogue in which, for many times, the community, the early church, could healthily argue and say, "I'm right," rather than "you are wrong." And it somehow or other out of that, dialogue, there could be a little bit more healthy situation. We don't seem to be able to do that. And part of that is our culture today, our American culture, which really pushes us away from being able to do that.
Well, I think Rich's remark last night was historically that we killed people for that, even then. So we didn't just come along with some American hangup what I read, and I'm not much, I don't know hardly anything about patristics, but what you read there, they could be right, downright insulting and carnival-like. You know, I'm told that, was it the Arian controversy? There were people outside the halls shouting, "There was a time when he was not. There was a time when he was not." I mean, it's kind of a carnival. So what's changed?
Last Thursday, I think I told you, Charlie, I was listening to a Jewish sociologist, and some of his stuff may have been a little wacky, but he was very, very firm on what we read in the New Testament is an inter-party debate. Now, very clear that Jesus was not outside the Jewish faith at all, period.
Some people claim two forms of Judaism survived to this time. Pharisaic Judaism and Christianity, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the argument.
Sadducees died out.
Yeah. They didn't believe in the resurrection anyway. So.
That's right.
You know, when I was growing up, I thought the Sadducees were the liberals, you know, because they didn't believe in the resurrection. And then you get to studying around and you find out the reason they didn't believe in the resurrection, it wasn't in the first five books of the law. They were the most conservative theologically. And that's another thing about how we have to watch things, about who's in and who's out by those definitions.
I have a question. When you think of 2 Corinthians 5, God was in Christ reconciling the world to himself, that seems to me to be an exclusive claim and yet inclusive. To think in that way, is that wrongheaded? Is that being condescending toward other faiths?
Well, a couple of responses. One is that it seems to me in Dietrich Bonhoeffer's Ethics, he has a statement that runs, and it's been years since I read that, but it seems to me it runs something to this sense that it's just exactly what you're saying, that in essence the church gets more exclusive of its proclamation, there is no salvation outside of the Christ, and then more inclusive about who is involved in that. You know, I mean, that we could spend a lot of time unpacking that, but, you know, and that's gotten to the places where some people, I think it's Hans Kuhn or whatever, talks about anonymous Christians and is that who it is? Who?
Carl Rahner,
okay. So anyway, there's all kinds of stuff, you know, people thinking about that. I got in trouble with my father-in-law when I first came to, he's a member of the parish I serve now, and I said, if you want to hear my heresy, my deepest heresy, do you? We're supposed to say, yeah, we want to hear
your father.
Well, my father-in-law did not want to hear my, but I said that probably at the root and heart of everything, I'm a universalist. Because I believe that somehow or another God will, that nothing will be lost in God's economy. But I also believe that somehow he will do that through Jesus the Christ. I don't know how, but I think that someday what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, that God, you know, that Christ will bring everything in under him, and then he will hand everything over to God, that God might be all in all. That's one thin little verse, but somehow the gospel as I know it through Jesus Christ just forces me to hope that that's true, that nothing will be lost, and that's in the whole of creation.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's my heresy. Yes, Carl.
You're not alone.
Yeah.
A lot of heretics here, folks, because that is a heretical position.
It is heretical. I identify, and it seems to me that it's precisely that Christ in the center, and that center part that is, again, so freeing that those walls start breaking down, and that's what that freedom is. You don't fear. You don't approach the world or other religions or whatever. I mean, there's that gospel is a freeing thing, and you can approach them as brothers because in Christ they're brothers, or sisters because in Christ they're sisters, and not on the basis of what the differences are that Jesus, I think, as the center, didn't recognize. I mean, that's the whole scandal of what he did, it seems, was he was about breaking down those walls that we're good at building up. And it seems to me the more you've got that center, the less concerned with boundaries.
I think there's a basic irrationality about God's economy that makes it impossible, maybe, or very difficult. We always think about evangelism as bringing people into the church, but the evangelistic mode of the New Testament is to give the church away. And Søren Kierkegaard, in The Tax on Christendom, I've shared this with a few, has this delightful little parable. None of them are delightful in The Tax on Christendom. I mean, they're awful. But he said, you know, when Jesus called people to become fishers of people, he intended that they become the bait. And he has this thing in which he says that what has happened in Denmark is that, and he thinks in all of Christendom, that the church turned it into a fishery business. And it's a marvelously profitable business because it has tax exemption and all this. And so it now is just canning fish. And it's quite profitable. And I think, you know, we can't get... See, we have this sense, and I have it... I mean, one of the things I worry about, and I absolutely do worry about this, is I think there is a distinctive Lutheran witness to be made. And so that means there's some necessity to have some boundaries and all of that, but we never know just how to do that in order to give ourselves... I mean... What happens if we gave ourselves away and all these crazy people came in that wanted to sing differently than we do? Or, you know, in the area of worship or what? I mean, it's just... And I don't know what to do with that tension. I mean, I'm glad this community struggles with those kinds of questions and that we don't get... I don't get many arenas where I can struggle with that because the folks... I mean, I'm real inarticulate, and they don't know even what he's talking about. So, but I think that's that. If we could learn, could trust to follow Jesus to give ourselves away, the question would look different. Is there going to be another generation? Well, whose problem is that? It's God's problem. But I have a pension plan, so we are. I mean, I think all that stuff gets mixed in there, God needs to give me the courage. See, I tell my people, and I could be fooling myself, that I don't. Lack of faith may be ultimately my problem, but I have diagnosed it that it's a lack of imagination, because I cannot imagine what it would be to sell all that I have. I cannot imagine what it would be to lay out, you know, to say that Holy Trinity Lutheran Church in Port Angeles is going to be a shelter for the homeless folks in Clallam County. That's a kind of a nice building, and they're kind of messy, and they might break some. They might even get in my office. Not very warm. I'll bet my office is really cold. There's something wrong with the heating system. I'm glad I'm not there now. It's worse than this. But anyway.
I read an illustration, which sort of follows up on this, maybe also with that castle motif that we built for ourselves. Kenan Callahan, who's a big church growth guru now, well, he's effective church and all that. Anyway, tells a story in one of his books about meeting in one church with a church growth committee, and he looked up and they had one of these big stained glass windows, which was a rendition of that famous painting of Jesus knocking on the door. And it occurred to him that when that painting was first done, when that stained glass window was done, the conclusion you were supposed to draw from that is that Jesus was knocking on the door so you could invite him in, whereas the message for the church of today is that Jesus was knocking on the door to call people out.
What you were saying a minute ago is a terrifying, radical reality, because it not only implies that, you know, we might suddenly have people who sing differently than us, but what is our cherished understanding of the faith that they may not want to embrace either? And that isn't necessarily just Northern European music. It could be inclusive language. It could be not just the building is suddenly a place for shelter. It could be that we sit in this kind of style. I mean, it's everything we hold, not just the stuff that we don't hold. And that's terrifying.
Increasingly, I've come to see how enculturated and captivated by it. I mean, there are a lot of people who dislike violently the prayer, the confession of sin that begins the LBW service, in which we confess that we are in bondage to sin and cannot free ourselves. I think they don't read on in the sense that there's a hope that if we can't do it, God can, and it seems to me the tradition says he'd take care of that. But he's awful slow with me. I mean, I keep getting in bondage to that. Well, I'm going to bring this to a close because I want to leave some time for people to move around and have a chance to get in on the book study, which I highly recommend. Are you in a series on that, or is this your first? Yeah. Let me just finish with a little quotation from Ernst Käsemann. And I read this book every January, just as a way to get going again. And the pages of the New Testament have shown us that Jesus' sovereignty is refracted in the most varied ways on earth, and that we are able to grasp it and translate it into action only fragmentarily according to the existing situation. The Lord is more than the disciple. Otherwise, the Lord would not remain our Lord. What we understand and achieve is patchwork, even under the power of the Holy Spirit, and is clouded by weakness, foolishness, and all earthly characteristics. So the gift remains ours only as long as we are constantly renewing our efforts to reach it, as those who are waiting and receiving the first beatitude. It is enough that we reach out with the world for Christ's freedom and let it consecrate us. But no one can be exempt from that, either during life or at death. No one can be deputized for here, even by the Lord. He is risen so that we may experience the power of Christ's resurrection and live by it. The call of freedom has been sounded. It concerns every one of us personally in our place, in our humanity, in this world of ours. The answer to it is the community of the free, and therefore the dawn of a new creation.